Everybody knows everybody, right? At least you know one person. You know the host. And you're the hostess, yeah? Yeah. So the topic that I've been discussing, and that I'd like to continue discussing, is Canto 10, Chapter 38, which is Akura's journey from Mathura to Vrindavan. It's very, besides it's very sweet, it's also very meaningful, practical, relevant for those who are practicing devotional service, sadhaka, bhakti. Here's why. Because, a little background, the connection is Akura is anticipating meeting Krishna. So, Akura is a part of the Yadu dynasty, as is Krishna. There's a relationship, family relationship. And he's sometimes called Uncle Akura, but he's much older than Uncle. And when Kamsa decided that he wanted to rule in Mathura, he was the son, he just put his father in prison. Didn't kill him, he just put him in prison. Later, Ugrasena becomes again the king when Kamsa is killed. But he put his father in prison and put his sister and Vasudev also in prison. And basically terrorized everybody. So those that were members of the Yadu dynasty, they scattered. They for their survival, because Kamsa could do anything at any time. However, some persons remained, and two persons we know that remained are Akura and Uddhava, also members of the Yadu dynasty. And Uddhava was around about the same age as Krishna, so contemporary, and Akura was very old in comparison to Krishna. But he stayed because he had heard, as everyone had heard, that the eighth child of Devaki would kill Kamsa, and he understood that eighth child of Devaki was Krishna. But he was a Krishna Bhakta, and he wanted to see Krishna. And so he stayed on. And sure enough, he got the chance to see Krishna. How he got the chance to see Krishna, because he wasn't about to defy Kamsa and just go see Krishna. Kamsa asked him. And he did politely. It would be very kind of you if you could assist me. Because he understood Akura's expertise, among other things. He was a statesman. He was like a minister that knew how to get things done for the king. So he was really skilled at that. And so when, this is still background, Narada Muni paid his second visit to Kamsa. Now, each time, everything that Narada does has one purpose, pleasing Krishna, because he's pure devotee. He doesn't have any interest other. But he did some, both times he did things that seemed like, how could a devotee do that? The first time he advised, you never know, Kamsa, the eighth child, but any one of them could be, could be a ruination. So you should kill all the children, daughters of, or sons of Devaki. Why would he do that? That's bad. You don't do that. But Narada has some gifts like Vyasadeva had. Narada's Trikalagya, past, present, future. No, he knew it all. So he knew many things that Kamsa didn't know. And one of them is the six sons of Devaki, the first six sons of Devaki, were to be killed by him because they were previously sons of Kalanemi, that whole story. And another reason given by our acharyas is that he wanted to hasten Krishna's appearance because Krishna's appearance meant that Kamsa would be killed, and that's part of the storyline that he knew would be happening, and so he wanted to instigate and hurry that up. And then when he visited the second time in Mathura, Kamsa received him very nicely, and so Narada said, "Oh, you've received me so nicely. I want to share with you something." The first time he said, the demigods are having a demigod conference and they're making a plan for the appearance of the eighth child of Devaki to kill you. So, Kamsa, you're smart. You know how to protect yourself. Do the needful. So the second time he said basically the same thing. Kamsa, I'll share with you a secret. And the secret is, remember that eighth child of Devaki? Well, Vasudeva, the eighth child of Devaki, was born. And Vasudeva carried the eighth child of Devaki the very night that he was born to the other side of the river Jamuna. And brought back a female child, and that was the female child that was not the eighth son of Devaki or eighth child of Devaki. It was Durga. So Kamsa grabbed his sword and said, I'm going to kill Vasudeva. He lied to me. He said, no. Don't kill Vasudeva. That's a bad plan. Because if you kill Vasudeva and Devaki, then Krishna will go and hide. And you won't be able to kill him. You have to have more of a problem. And besides, it's not Vasudeva, it's the eighth child of Vasudeva and Devaki. Put your attention over there. Get him. And I've got a plan how you can get him. What's that? You can send another demon or two, but in case that fails, you can always bring him here. And here's how you can do it. You plan a big festival with the brahmanas and this and that, and you invite everybody from Braja to come, and Krishna will come, guest of honor, and you kill him. Kamsa, you're really powerful. He said, very good. Very good. So he sent Keshi. This was in the evening. He sent Keshi that came the next morning. Keshi came the next morning. Narada came after Krishna killed Keshi, midday, and Akura arrived the next day evening. So Kamsa called his ministers. Narada left and went to Vrindavan the next day and met with Krishna and said all kinds of things. Kamsa met with his ministers, said, well, you know, this is the plan. Keshi, you go. You're my most trusted, powerful, formidable associate. Go kill Krishna. And in case that fails, I'll call Akura to bring Krishna here and Kovalyapita and the wrestlers, and he'll be finished. So the plan was made. They departed. Good plan. And then he called for Akura, and it was very polite. I mean, the language is very polite. Akuraji, you're so trusted, you're so capable, flattery. I'm relying upon you. Can you please help me? I mean, even Ravana spoke like politely with Maricha until he said no. He was very polite. I want your help. I'm depending upon you. So, Kura didn't decline. He told him the whole plan. This, that, the other thing. Kill him. How was planning to kill him? Now, there are different versions of commentary that say, you know, ministers are obliged. A good minister tells the truth, even if it's uncomfortable. So you're bringing Krishna here is inviting your death. But I'm happy to go see Krishna. I'm happy to bring him here. I mean, that's commentary. He doesn't say that in the verses of the Bhagavatam. So he spent the night in Mathura, and then at dawn the next morning, it says he didn't go at night because he didn't know the path. So he went in the morning because then he could see the path. The path. And the path between Mathura and Vrindavan by Tanga, I did this once, like I wanted to be in the mood of Akura going to Vrindavan and read the whole section. It's really nice. Got in a tanga, and it took about an hour and a half. And it took Akura all day. And the reason it took Akura all day is he was just lost in bliss. He didn't know where he was. He was just anticipating with such eagerness to meet Krishna. He was not really paying attention to go from point A to point B. The horse got him there, though. And the section that we're reading from is after his departure, there's 22 verses where, according to the commentaries, he's already a pure devotee, but he's experiencing the waves of prema. The waves of prema means mixing of bhavas and this bhava. So it's like an ocean, and then sometimes a wave goes up and it stays up, and sometimes a wave is a small wave and it mixes with the big waves. So these mixing of these waves is compared, it's a comparison to prema. Prema is just a mixing of bhavas with the primary mood in his case. In the case of Akura, it's dasya. Dasya rasa. His mood is the servant. He's uncle. And he pays his respects as a servant pays respects to the master. But it's kind of unusual, because Krishna is 11 years, 8 months, and Akura is an old man with a beard, gray and white hair. He's, you know, very elderly, but he's in his mood in relation to Krishna. So, this a little bit of how rasa works. This is like a little nectar devotion class over here. But it's there's 5 primary rasas, and each of those 5 primary rasas, they're supported by a nice Sanskrit term, sthayi bhava, steady ecstasy. So the 5 are neutrality, servitorship, friendship, parental affection, and conjugal love. And they're ascending in order of intimacy. Neutrality, servitorship, friendship, parental affection, conjugal love. So that's the sthayi bhava. I'm going like this because it's compared to explain how rasa works, it's compared to an axle. And then there's wheels on the axle. When the wheels turn, the axle turns. Or when the axle turns, the wheel turns. You know, in cars, there's a drive shaft and it turns the axle, it turns the wheels. But there's no drive shaft in this metaphor, it's just an axle. And things, the axle is moved by two primary bhavas, vibhava and alambana. Sorry for the Sanskrit terms, but vibhava means a rising of some ecstasy, and alambana has two parts, and that's ashraya vishaya. Ashraya is the abode of love, that's the devotee, occurs heart. He is the vessel or the abode that holds love for Krishna. And then there's the object of love, vishaya. And then there's another part, and that's that which stimulates that love. So the abode of love, the object of love, and that which stimulates that love, udipana, stimulates the love. So there's a particular rasa, or staibhava, that's the axle, and it's within that there is the some love, and then there's the object of love, and that which stimulates includes things like Krishna's flute, or his flute playing, or his smile, or his peacock feather, or his cloth, and etc., 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 his glance. These are stimulations. And then when the love, the abode of love, is stimulated towards the object of love by these udipanas, then different ecstasies come. And when the ecstasies come and they mix and they mix and they mix, that's what rasa is. Rasa is a mixing of different bhavas, some rising, some falling, some staying high, some little this and that. And that's rasa. Bhakti rasa. Rupa Goswami teaches that the essence of the spiritual world is bhakti rasa, where there is the object of love, the abode of love, stimulations of that love, and different types of bodily transformations, and so forth and so on. Then there's a very detailed description. So, back to Akura. He's experiencing dasya rasa that has this bhava, and then that recedes, and then that bhava, and then that recedes, and then another one, and then he goes back to the first one, and it's a mixing of ecstasies. These verses described by your acharyas, it's just an outburst of bhava, and then another one, and then another one. That's why it took him all day. He was just in an ocean of ecstasy in dasya rasa. And even sometimes during these verses, he speaks about the exalted love of the gopis. And there's no impropriety. He's not imitating or pretending to be a gopi. He is appreciating the exaltedness of the love of the gopis and Nanda and Yashoda and so on. So there are things that is called rasa-basa, inappropriate mixture, but there's none of that. It's just he is just appreciating their love that stimulates his love as a servant. And there's all kinds of things going on. So now we're ready for the text. Just covering one text. But it's number four in a series of four. So you hear reference to verse 11, 12, and 13, and this is 14. So this 14 is kind of a summary of the first three we're going to hear. And starting with 11, just quickly, overview. Up to 11, it's just ecstasy, then of different types. Starting with 11, he's now going to focus on the object, which results in stimulation of his love. He's identifying the object of his love, who he's not seen with his eyes, but he's seen in his heart, because that's described. It's those who have prema, the Lord appears voluntarily within their heart. You can't see Krishna in your heart unless he voluntarily appears within your heart. What to speak of then externally? So he's able to see Krishna within his heart, but he's really eager to see Krishna directly. Which is different. Meditation is non-different, but different. So he's not just a meditator. He is a meditator in devotion. He meditates in devotion on Krishna, and he sees Krishna in his heart. Now he's going to see him in person. And he considers this like a just crescendo of mercy from Krishna coming through, of all people, Kamsa. Because Kamsa can't deliver Krishna's mercy unless Krishna makes him an instrument of his mercy. So he's really thankful for Krishna's mercy, even as coming through Kamsa. He's going to go see Krishna. So we'll hear what these 11, 12, and 13 have to say as we're discussing 14. Srimad Bhagavatam is very nice. So he's not speaking to anybody. These are his thoughts. Because he's on the chariot alone. He's got to bring two passengers back, Krishna Balaram. So he's alone. And the mood that's relevant to us specifically is the anticipation of meeting Krishna. Because we're way down here, we're inside of the bhakti stage, and he's way up there in the prema bhakti stage. But the principle of anticipating of being with Krishna, connecting with Krishna, is true at all the different stages. We'll say it differently. Same thing. Those who are practicing sadhana bhakti should not see sadhana bhakti as a pious activity. It's one of the offenses to be avoided when chanting the holy name, is to consider the chanting of the holy name a pious activity, because pious activities bring you fruits of piety, and bhakti isn't meant to bring you fruits of piety. It goes way beyond. It's transcendental. Beyond piety, impiety. Beyond good and bad, beyond anything of this world. So, his ecstasy is anyway, so the verses are focusing on his anticipation of seeing Krishna in transcendental mood. So it's 10:38:14. 10:38:14. Today, I shall certainly see him, the goal and spiritual master of the great souls. Seeing him brings jubilation to all who have eyes, for he is the true beauty of the universe. Indeed, his personal form is the shelter desired by the goddess of fortune. Now, all the dawns of my life have become auspicious. There's a lot of poetry packed in that verse. Here's some commentary. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur writes, I will certainly be able to see that blissful form, seen by the discerning men full of love, rasa, and pastimes, which is the object of the sight of Lakshmi, who resides on Vishnu's chest, because many dawns have been auspicious for me. If it were otherwise, I would not get the result I'm about to receive. He's lived his life anticipating what is about to happen. Just like when we do some devotional practice, worship of your deity, or chanting of Krishna's name, or singing some bhajans, or going in the kitchen and cooking for Krishna. It's not just cooking, or just even cooking for your family, it's cooking for Krishna. And the anticipation, the devotional mode is anticipating that this should be so nice that Krishna will be pleased. And that consciousness is transferred through the medium of the activity. The consciousness of love and devotion to Krishna is transferred through the medium, let's say, of cooking. And then when that cooking is offered to Krishna, it's very special. And then those who take the remnants of that which has been cooked in the mood of devotion for Krishna experience something. I'm going to tell a little story. This devotee over here is Vibhu Chaitanya Das. There's a disciple of Prabhupada who I met in Vrindavan. Name was Vibhu Chaitanya. And I've told him this story before. He was very old, and he had a back problem such that he couldn't stand up straight. He walked at a tilt, and his arms were behind his back when he walked. He looked like a bird ready to take off. And he was so regulated, he would come in to greet the deities during Mangal Arati. He couldn't pay obeisances, so he would, you know, in his own way, offer his prayers to each of the three altars. And then he would go in the kitchen and cook for Radha Shamasundar. He has a very small deity kitchen. And he wouldn't come out until the midday offering was completed, Raj Bhog offering was completed. So just watching him, I hadn't really interacted with him because he was always in the deity kitchen. But I was so moved just to see him. I could feel his devotion. So I made a request through somebody. I was teaching for 1 month in the Vrindavan Institute for Higher Education. So I asked, can I get something from his offering? To Radha Shamasundar, to their offering that he had cooked. And arrangement was made every day. And so for 1 month, what I got was, you know, a leaf cup. You know what leaf cups are, right? They're about that big. And it was sabji, whatever was the sabji for that day. And it was so satisfying that that's all I had for lunch every day for a month. Now that's not what my normal lunch looks like, but it was so satisfying because of the love and devotion with which he cooked. It was so satisfying. I felt that love and devotion. That was the energy that kept me going through that whole month. So, anything that you do with love and devotion for Krishna, Krishna accepts, and it has its spiritual impact on others. Whatever it is that you like to do, you do it for Krishna, and you do it for Krishna with love. So this is Akura. He was really wanting to see Krishna. Now, the service, as far as Kamsa was concerned, was bring him here so I can kill him. And as far as he was concerned, take him to Kamsa so he can kill Kamsa. And in killing Kamsa, it meant the Yadu dynasty would be relieved of their fear of this terrible person. And he was like really powerful. Long stories about how powerful Kamsa was. He wasn't an ordinary guy. He was really mean, he was really powerful. Long stories. Really powerful. So, Jiva Goswami writes, Kamsa Akura has spoken about general qualities of Krishna. Now he's going to speak about Krishna's special qualities. Some of Krishna's special qualities. So it begins, today I will see him. The word tu indicates that he, Akura, has special fortune greater than all the Yadavas. I will certainly see him today. He is approachable by the great devotees and he gives instructions. This indicates the goal, that's being with Krishna, and then sadhya, and the means to reach the goal, sadhana, which includes hearing instructions. We're doing the sadhana that's meant to take us to the goal. That's the, for me, that's the connection. It's one of the things that enlivens me so much about this section. It's very practical, very relevant to our lives as practitioners, sadhakas. He's at the mature stage of that. Previously, Akura explained Krishna's beauty in a general way. Now he gives some specific details. His beauty surpasses that of anyone in the lower, middle, and upper planetary systems, and even in Vaikuntha, including Mahanarayana. He, Krishna, gives great joy to those who see him, his associates. The Lord of the city of Mahakala said, in this case, Mahakala means the abode of Mahavishnu. So he makes reference to a verse from chapter 89 of Canto 10. This is where the sons of a Brahmana were taken one by one. After their birth, they disappeared. And he started criticizing Ugrasena. What kind of king are you? You can't even protect a Brahmana's sons right after they're born, one after the next. What kind of king are you? And Krishna, so-called. So he was like, he was upset. And Arjuna had happened to be visiting during that period of time, and he heard the criticism. So he went to the Brahmana. And this is chapter 89. He went to the Brahmana and said, my dear Brahmana, I promise you, I will protect your son so there won't be any difficulty, and if I fail, I'll give up my life. So the Brahmana trusted him because he's Arjuna. So when the child was to be born, Arjuna was called, and Arjuna with arrows built some invincible shield so no one could enter. And after the child was born, the child disappeared. And Arjuna was bewildered. So he searched high and low for who might have done this. He couldn't find who, the child or who had done this. So he built a fire and he was going to enter into the fire. And Krishna stopped him and said, no. Don't do that. I know where the child is. I'll take you there. So in Krishna's chariot, it's really far out chapter if you want to read something far out. They get in the chariot and they go beyond all the upper planetary systems through the layers of the universe, and describes what that's like, and then they went on the other side of the layers of the universe, and there's the causal ocean, and then there's the Brahmajyoti on the other side of the causal ocean. And they went to the abode of Mahavishnu. And that's Mahakala. But we're going to hear some other things. So here's the verse that Jiva Goswami is quoting. It's text 58 from chapter 89. Mahavishnu says to Krishna, I brought the Brahmana's sons, plural, here because I wanted to see the two of you who have descended to the earth to save the principles of religion. As soon as you finish killing the demons who burden the earth, quickly come back here to see me. Now I'm going to read, that was text 58. There's some other descriptions of what Mahakala means. I hope you don't mind hearing. There's different meanings. So text 52, that's six verses before the one we just read. Here's the translation. From that region, they entered a body of water resplendent with huge waves being churned by a mighty wind. Within that ocean, Arjuna saw an amazing palace. This is Mahavishnu's ocean, Karna Ocean. Huge waves. In the midst was an amazing palace, more radiant than anything he had ever seen before. Its beauty was enhanced by thousands of ornamental pillars bedecked with brilliant gems. Now, I want you to hear the commentary by Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur. They entered the causal ocean, Shalilam, ornamented with huge waves agitated by strong wind, and saw a wondrous abode, Adbhutam Bhavanam, called Mahakala, the abode of Mahavishnu. Sridhar Swami describes this city by quoting from another text, Mrityunjaya Tantra. And the quote goes, O Devi, apparently this is Lord Shiva speaking to Uma, O Devi, above this universe is the great celestial abode of Brahma. Above that are the abodes of the expansions of Lord Vishnu. Expansions of Lord Vishnu. And above that are the abodes of the Rudra expansions of Lord Shiva. Above that is the abode of Mahavishnu, above which there is the supreme residence of Mahadevi. Above her abode lies time, which strikes fear in all. Beyond it is the ever-fresh spiritual ocean of the nectar of Brahman, along whose shores Lord Mahakala appears as the supreme controller of all beings. It continues, in this context, Brahma's abode is Satyaloka. The abode of the expansion of Vishnu refers to a material planet called Vaikuntha, where the demigods, sons of Mother Vaikuntha, reside. The abode of the expansions of Rudra is Rudraloka, located within the covering of the shell of false ego. It's one of the shells of the universe, shell of false ego, Ahankara. The abode of Mahavishnu is the Mahavishnu Loka, located within the covering shell of the Mahatattva, which is on the other side of the covering, the seven shells covering each universe. Each shell represents something, or not represents, is the abode of these different elements that are necessary for what's inside the universe. So the Mahatattva is one of those elements. And the abode of Mahavishnu is the Mahavishnu Loka, located within the covering shell of the Mahatattva. The abode of Mahadevi is Mahadevi Loka, located within the covering shell of unmanifest Prakriti. The ocean of the nectar of Brahman, the ocean of the nectar of Brahman is called the causal ocean Mahakala, or Mahavaikunthanath, which is the Lord of Mahavaikuntha, or Mahakala Puram, situated in the spiritual sky within the water of the causal ocean. I hope you're holding on to your socks because that's really high. And I spent some time this morning going through what are some other references. Mahakala has this specific identification, but it has many. It's used because Mahakala means great time. So here's a reference from chapter 50, canto 10, where Mahakala is an aspect of Lord Shiva. Then here's from Brahma Samhita. You're familiar with Brahma Samhita. Govindam Adipurusham. So from that Govinda prayers, there's a description of Mahakala. This one is Goloka namni nijadamni talecha tasya devi maheshu haridama suteshu teshu. That verse. So this is the commentary by Bhaktisiddhanta. Above Devi Dham is located Shiva Dham, one portion of which, called Mahakala Dham, is enveloped in darkness. Interpenetrating this portion of Shiva Dham, there shines the Sada Shiva Loka, full of great light. Sada Shiva, Shiva Tattva is a very, very difficult subject, because most people, when they think of Lord Shiva, it's one aspect of Lord Shiva. He lives in Kailash and he does what he does. He gives benedictions and he's worshipped by people, and that's one aspect. And there's like seven aspects of him, because one of those is Sadashiva. That's in the same, it's not Shiva Tattva, it's Vishnu Tattva, known as Sadashiva. Very complicated. And they go all the way down to the bottom of the universe, where the Rudras that appear that destroy the universe at the end of cosmic manifestation, that's where they reside. Okay. And then the final reference, I can't remember where this comes from. I'll just read. I'll probably remember as I'm reading it. According to Sri Nandishwara, you know who Nandishwara is. According to Sri Nandishwara, Lord Shiva remains always in one form, meaning that he is not like Mahakala, sometimes formless and sometimes having a personal form. So this is, it's Brihat Bhagavatamrita, and Gopakumar also went through the layers of the universe. Now he's on the other side of the layers of the universe, and he is encountering on the other side of the universe Mahakala. Another feature of Mahakala, which is the impersonal aspect of the Supreme that Gopakumar saw sometimes emerging from amorphousness into some form and seeming to draw him into Brahman, and then would fade and disappear because he continued chanting his Gopal mantra, and then would come again. So is it I can only think of this in terms of like an animated video of, you know, something that comes from this kind of entity or blob or whatever, cloud, and comes into some form and then recedes back. That's Mahakala, according to Sanatana Goswami in Brihat Bhagavatamrita. And Lord Shiva doesn't do like that. This particular Mahakala reference is, that's an aspect of Brahman. And then he continues, later that same chapter, Mahakalapura is the abode of liberation. In that Mukti Pada, liberated souls merge into Sayuja in intense meditation on Brahman. Mahakalapura is a suitable destination for impersonal sannyasis. So if you ever wanted to know, I've wanted to know sometimes what happens to those that actually become realized in Brahman, where do they go? Well, Sayuja Mukti, well, where is there some, there's a place for them. And that's this Mahakalapur that's in this region that was already identified. It's the abode of liberation, abode of Sayuja liberation, or Muktipada place. So that was a little detour. The reference, going back to Krishna's form is so attractive that Mahavishnu wanted to see. And he couldn't descend from the causal ocean into this realm, so he made an arrangement so Krishna would come see him. And that's all he wanted. He stole the Brahmin's sons, so Krishna would come and he could see Krishna. And then he's inviting Krishna, when you finish your pastimes, please come see me again. So the form of Krishna is very special. That was the reference. Here's Uddhava speaking the same thing. This is Canto 3, Bhagavatam, Chapter 2. Krishna possesses that form suitable for human pastimes to show the full capacity of his yoga maya. That form astonishes even the Lord of Vaikuntha. It is the pinnacle of auspicious qualities and enhances the beauty of his ornaments. Meaning, ornaments are supposed to enhance the beauty of someone. But Krishna's beauty is so superb, it enhances the beauty of the ornaments. And even the Lord of Vaikuntha, according to Uddhava, he is thrilled and charmed and astonished by the beauty of Krishna, as is Mahavishnu. So, commentary continues. Not only is that form of Krishna in Braja, more beautiful than all beautiful forms such as Narayana, but it is attractive to the best of his Shaktis, even Lakshmi, the shelter of all good fortune, desires to take shelter of that form, rather than Narayan. And there's the whole story of her desiring like that. She wanted to enter the Rasa dance. You know that story. Anyone not know that story? Okay, you know the story. Next is a reference. Jiva Goswami quotes Canto 10, Chapter 16. This is the Kaliya Leela, where the wives of the Kaliya serpent pray, O Lord, we do not know how the serpent Kali has attained this great opportunity of being touched by the dust of your lotus feet. For this end, even the goddess of fortune performed austerities for centuries, giving up all other desires and taking austere vows. So the pastime. She heard about Rasa dance. She wanted to enter the Rasa dance. She wanted to experience it. And so she went to perform austerities, according to this text, for centuries. She still couldn't enter Rasa dance. And she was perplexed. And the answer was she wasn't allowed because her mood is, I'm the goddess of fortune. And the residents of Vrindavan don't have that mood. It's just sweetness. So how do you get that good fortune? By the association of those who have that good fortune, the residents of Vrindavan. This is a very important teaching of Rupa Goswami, the teaching of Raganuga Bhakti. Raganuga Bhakti is spontaneous devotion as opposed to regulative. There's regulative and there's spontaneous. And one can go from regulative to spontaneous by associating with the perfected devotee in the spontaneous place, the associates of Krishna and Braja. This is a very simple but very cornerstone teaching of Braja Prem or Braja Bhakti that Lord Chaitanya wanted to give. And Rupa Goswami explains it in detail in Nectar Devotion. So, continuing, quoting Ukura, my many mornings, for for a long time we'll be blessed with seeing him. There is no other result like this. So he comments, this verse may also be considered a continuation of the previous three verses. I'll just finish this section and we'll stop, because it goes on. Akura is thinking, how is it that he is hard to attain, and attaining him is so glorified? If he is attained, how can he be attained so easily? You consider yourself most fortunate because of that easy attainment. That's a doubt. The answer is in four verses. So we'll go through them. His rarity and greatness are expressed in the first two verses. And we'll hear what those first two verses are. He makes reference to a logic in Nyaya that is called Kaimutya. Kaimutya logic is, if you establish this, you don't have to establish that because it's inferred. The example, here's two examples. If I have 10 fruits, that I have fruits goes without saying. That's the classic from Nyaya to explain what does this particular logic mean. If you have this, you have that. Or here's another example. Only Nishkam worship without some desire to Lord Vishnu brings religion, wealth, and sense gratification and liberation, dharma, artha, kama, moksha. Only, which means that it doesn't happen by other forms of worship. If this, then that is true without having to state it. So, back to the logic that he's referring to, the logic is, there's something very special about this form. That means it's not that something special isn't available in other forms. That's otherwise special doesn't hold. His rarity and greatness is expressed in the first two verses. Here's verse 11. Because he glances, this is Mahavishnu, he glances, creating cause and effect, and in his glancing, he's not absorbed in doing so. He has spiritual potency, chit shakti, and he can destroy illusion and difference. The difference meaning it's previously discussed. Seeing things as having a separate existence from him, or so that for us. We make material consciousness to see things separate from him. So here's a nice orchid, right? Very colorful, probably very fragrant. So if I see that as separate from Krishna, I want to be the enjoyer of that something. Oh, it's beauty, and oh, it's fragrance, and oh, this and that. And that separateness, one who is connected with Krishna doesn't fall prey to that seeing things separate. They see things in relation to Krishna. There's no separateness when you're connected to Krishna. So Krishna doesn't see separateness, and those connected to Krishna don't see separateness. They're not in Maya. They're protected. We can become protected from illusion and all that goes with it by the connectedness with Krishna, because Krishna has chit shakti. And that principle is showing what Krishna does, or what Mahavishnu, just by glancing, which he's not attached to, it creates the cause and effect of everything. The whole cosmic manifestation, which is resting on cause and effect, he's not attached to it. It's remote control. So you become a simile, you become attached to Krishna. This is Akura. I want to be attached to him because I don't want to be involved in the cause and effect and happiness and distress and pleasure and pain and up and down and duality of material existence and illusion and all that goes with it. I want to be with him. That's his meditation. That's the first verse. That's something very special. Then the next one, that was verse 11. Being invisible to all, that's Vishnu. Vishnu is not seen, but he's all-pervasive to all. Being invisible to all, since he acts by his glance, he can only be inferred but not seen in all beings by ordinary living entities that have senses, that have a mind, they're endowed by this process of creation with different things. We can infer, it's making reference to a verse from the second canto Bhagavatam, we can understand the presence of Krishna everywhere by taking help of the intelligence. But we can't do that without Krishna giving the intelligence. And if Krishna doesn't give the intelligence, you can't even infer his presence. You're an atheist or agnostic or something, a materialist of one kind or another. But by his association, one can infer his presence. Even you can't see him yet. Those who are unqualified to see him can understand his presence by inference, since they lack capacity on their own being produced by his glance. That's the effect, the covering. Then to support what he's saying, this is this verse. Those of you that like to research things, you can make note. Canto 2, chapter 2, text 35 is that verse that says you can understand, infer the presence of the Supreme Lord by help of intelligence. So his translation, Jiva Goswami, the Shanta Bhakta sees the Supreme Lord in all beings by the mercy of Paramatma. The Lord and the Jiva are inferred by symptoms such as their observable intelligence. It's a really long purport. You have to read it a few times to follow step by step how it works. But it's understanding the Supreme by inference. Then his commentary goes on. Even his angsas, what's our angsas? His parts. Living entities are his angsas. Mam eva angsa jiva loke jiva bhuta sanatana. Even his angsas, that's us, are hard to see, as expressed in the following. Vishtabhyaham idam krishnam. Another angsa is the supersoul. I am spread throughout the universe by just one angsa, one of my portions. That's Bhagavad Gita verse 10:41. Chapter 10 is Opulences of the Absolute. Arjuna asks Krishna, oh, please describe to me ways by which I can always think of you. So Krishna describes his opulences, vibhutis. And this vibhuti, that vibhuti, that vibhuti. And then he says, the list can go on forever. What's the use of such a list when but as an angsa of myself, I pervade and support the entire universe? All those vibhutis are supported by just a fraction of me. And the last of Jiva Goswami's commentary, verse 12, indicates the glory of attaining realization of even the expansions of the Lord. Verse 13 indicates the reason that it is easy for a Kura to see the Lord. And then this verse, 14, summarizes everything. And that summary is, I'm most fortunate. That's the gratitude in the heart of a devotee. And now gratitude is really important, just like in families. Family members make sacrifices for one another. Parents are sacrificing left and right for each other and their children. And so one can just be, gee, thanks. And then another is a deeper sense of gratitude, and that is, I want to do something for those who are sacrificing for me. That's love. There's receiving, and there's giving. Giving from a place of love. And that's where akura is. That's what bhakti is. One wants to do something because he's the maintainer of everyone. We're grateful to those who are maintaining us, and who's maintaining those who are maintaining us. Everything comes from the source of everything. I'll just quote one more verse and we'll finish. Nityo nityanam chaitanas chaitananam eko bohunam yovididati kaman. It's an Upanishad verse. It's in same verse in two different Upanishads that Prabhupada quoted a lot. So there's eka is maintaining the many. Eko bohunam yovididati kaman. So there are persons who are maintaining us, and there's one who's maintaining those who are maintaining us. And there's gratitude for being maintained. Just like, say, maybe you're not, you know, mother and father, you're just a friend. And a friend is going through whatever they're going through, and we're there for them. And there's some gratitude for somebody who's there for them. But who's there for the one who's there for them? That's gratitude. It's when we understand the position of Krishna in some detail, like Akura is presenting, when you understand that, you feel something. You feel gratitude. And then that feeling of gratitude is, I want to do something. Now, in his case, it's not just he wants to see him. Sounds selfish. I want to see him. He wants to serve him. And he wants to serve in the way that Krishna will be able to serve others, and that, you know, go to Mathura and annihilate Kamsa and do all the rest that he does after that. Because he appeared in this world for those reasons. To annihilate Vinashaya Shaduskritam. So he's being an instrument for that. He's very happy to serve. And there's something very special about service, and there's something very special about seeing the object of service. He's feeling very fortunate. Rightly so. So now what about us? We should also be eager to see the object of our service. It's remote service, presently, through sadhana, but to come to the more elevated stage where we can be with Krishna. And with coward boys, play with Krishna, or etc., etc., all the different rasas. The eagerness to achieve the mature stage of bhakti is important to get there. So, let's see if there's some discussion. There are people watching remotely, probably, so we'll go to those online questions after we spend some time with people who are present who would like to raise a question or hear some discussion.
Thank you so much, Maharaji. That's a very wonderful class, and we are truly feeling blessed. So, Maharaji, I have a question, like, because you refer about this cosmic manifestation.
Yeah.
Right, the upper planetary systems and the lower planetary systems.
Yeah.
So, what type of people, I'm just talking about the human beings, what type of people go there after death?
People go which place?
Yeah, which planets... what type of people go there, to which planet, which planetary system, which layers of the planets?
Who are you referring to?
Like, you see, but if the person after dies...
It depends on where the soul goes. This is a general question, or general answer, and you may have a more specific question in mind. Where the soul goes depends upon where the mind is fixed, or what you're attached to, or what your consciousness is. So you'll go to a different location depending upon what consciousness you've developed during this lifetime. It can go down, or it can go up, or it can go beyond.
Oh, okay.
And even the beyond has different venues. different places. So there's this mood, there's that mood, and there's another mood, and there's another mood. Mm-hmm. And you'll go to that place according to what you're attached to, the consciousness that you've developed. Now you have more specific question?
Oh, no, I think I got it. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's do this. The seven lower planetary systems we're familiar with. The seven upper, from the Gayatri Mantra, we know the first three, and then there's four more after that. Bhu, Bhuvar, and Swargaloka.
Mm-hmm.
And one goes to each of those places depending. And then above Swargaloka is Maharloka, Janloka, Tapaloka, Brahmaloka. That's the four, in addition to the three, makes seven upper.
Okay.
And so you can read in Brihad Bhagavatamrita, just say very quickly, Maharloka is for householders who are very absorbed in the process of sacrifice. They're absorbed in it because their consciousness is so elevated, they don't just do sacrifice, but the Lord of sacrifice, Yajna, appears from the fire and extends his hands to receive directly from them whatever they offer. And when the yajna is over, he recedes. And then you start another yajna. They're yajna fans. And he reciprocates because of their elevated consciousness. And then there's not much spoken about the above Maharloka is Janaloka. And then there's Tapaloka, it's celibates only. And they do meditation. And in their meditation, they see the Lord in meditation. And when they take a meditation break, they have very, very elevated philosophical discussions. And they take a little snack, and then they go back to meditation. That's Tapaloka, Tapa. And then above Tapaloka is Brahmaloka. And then there's the layers of the universe. And there's living entities. It's not like a crust or something like that. Mm-hmm. It's elements, but there's personalities, and there's worship, and it's very interesting. Brihad Bhagavatamrita describes. And then there's on the other side of that. So some may go to one of those regions.
Yeah.
Gopa Kumar was invited, why don't you stay here, why don't you stay there? He kept going. And then on the other side, so there's living entities on the other side. That's where this Mahakala that would appear and then recede, the impersonal Brahman would seem to take some shape and invite him into that impersonal Sayuja place, and he resisted it. And then above that is Shivaloka. Shivaloka is not the same, I'm sorry for the detail, but Shivaloka is not the same as Kailash. Kailash is in the heavenly realm, and Shivaloka is beyond the layers of the universe. In the Brahmajyoti region, beyond, that's Shivaloka, or Maheshdham. And then there's Haridham. And the top of Haridham is Ayodhya Dham. It's in the Vaikuntha realm, but it's the topmost. And then there's Goloka Dham. So where you go depends upon consciousness. What you cultivate during this life will determine where you go.
Yeah.
And then there's for those higher realms, it's not spin the dial. There's standards and practices and teachings and teachers, and then if you qualify, then you can go there. We're going to go somewhere.
So, Maharaji, is there any reference in our scriptures, or is there any way, suppose if a person falls into this lower planetary system, that living being can directly
can
go to the upper planetary system without taking birth in the planet Earth or Bhuvarloka?
Most likely, and I don't know of any specific reference, but some of those lower planetary systems are inhabited by pure devotees, like Bali Maharaj, for example. Or Yamaraj, for example. So those are two examples of pure devotees, and through association of pure devotees, one can achieve the highest. But the disposition of those persons who are getting their association may not be ready to receive the fullness of what that pure devotee has to offer, so they get something more than just gradual, so many lifetimes of elevation. That would be the norm. Gradual. But through association of great souls, one may achieve very high destination.
Thank you, Maharaj.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Maharaj, again for your presence here. I remember first time I saw you, my younger one who was actually outside with friends, but she was in my lap and I had to keep her quiet in Minneapolis so I can listen to you. So it's really wonderful.
Minneapolis?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So I do have questions. Like he said, soul's journey. I believe like soul is always there with super soul or Paramatma. So I should always feel like wherever I am, whatever upper, lower, loka, but that Paramatma will always be with me.
Yes, definitely.
So I shouldn't be thinking anything else except that I'm always, as long as I can feel that connection and keep my focus, that I'm always there with Super Soul.
Okay.
Is that correct?
It's correct because that's what you're feeling. So that's correct.
But like we say, when person dies, soul leaves the body. So then Paramatma or Super Soul also leave that materialistic body. But then again, the soul and Paramatma, Super Soul, they have the journey together wherever they are going?
Well, Super Soul doesn't have to do anything, but he does. Because he's very kind. And where the soul goes, which will then determine where the Paramatma accompanying the soul goes, is determined by the consciousness of the soul. And there's all kinds of opportunities. I mean, the range is without limit. Upper and lower and beyond upper and transcendental. And so that's important. The other, what you said is of supermost importance, and what kind of mood or relationship would you like with not just Paramatma, because that's a stage or an aspect of the Supreme, but Bhagavan. Paramatma is a subset of Bhagavan. Mm-hmm. So which aspect of Bhagavan is are you or each one of us inclined to? And then within that aspect of Bhagavan, what kind of relationship? This is the rasa question. So it is significant. What you said is significant, and the relationship with Bhagavan is likewise significant. And to the degree to which we cultivate a relationship with Bhagavan, along with respecting the Paramatma as our dearmost friend who will always accompany us wherever we go, what kind of exchange or nature or feeling would we like to have with the personal feature of Bhagavan? That's what bhakti teaches.
I do have a few more questions,
okay.
But hopefully those are shorter ones.
Go right ahead.
Recently, I missed a tiny part, so I'm asking you again, but I know you were explaining in one of your lectures about twice born. And this word always keeps me like confused.
Why?
Because how is it twice born?
Oh.
Like wherever we are born.
Spiritual birth. There's the body, that's the firstborn. And then second born is a spiritual birth. The mother and father don't give spiritual birth. They give the material one. And twice born is the spiritual birth, the awakening of spiritual consciousness. And the mother and father, for twice born. The mother is the Vedas, and the father is the spiritual master. And then comes twice born. And traditionally, I've just been hearing Prabhupada say this over and over in recorded lectures, Brahmana, Kshatriya, and Vaishya, they would receive Diksha from Guru on the authority of the Vedas. So that's twice born. The duties of the Vaishya, Kshatriya, and Brahmana differ, but they're all twice born. It's a spiritual birth. That's the second birth.
So when we are understanding twice born, so like Brahmana, Kshatriya, especially more like Kshatriya and other Vaishnava,
Vaishya,
and Shudra.
Not Shudra.
So, not,
they're not twice born. They're not given. In traditional Vedic culture, a Shudra can become elevated, but traditional Vedic culture doesn't acknowledge that. They'd have to become, get a lot of training and purification so that they're guna and karma match that of a Vaishya, Kshatriya, or Shudra, or Brahmana. Lots of training. But just speaking now of birth, by birth, one whose guna and karma is Shudra, they're not given mantra and study of the Vedas. They don't have the quality. They can be elevated. So, now back to, we'll go down. Brahmana, Kshatriya, and Vaishya. Just like Krishna, he was born in a family, a Kshatriya family, Vasudeva and Devaki, and he didn't get his Gayatri mantra till he was 12. And then he became twice born. Now, that was a pastime. He doesn't need anything. But it's the pastime illustrating, or, you know, showing by example. Now, let's go back to what I want to hear what your question is. Is this answering your question?
Yes. And to continue with this understanding, when they are getting spiritual birth or Diksha, then are they all becoming Vaishnava? Do we call them Vaishnava, Kshatriya, or Vaishnava?
It depends. Not always. Vaishnava means specifically they understand the purpose of their duties is to please Vishnu. But supposing somebody doesn't understand that, can they receive Diksha? Yes. Can they become a non-Vaishnava Brahmana? Yes. A non-Vaishnava Kshatriya? Yes. A non-Vaishnava Vaishya? Yes. But Vaishnava means specifically they recognize the purpose of their duties is to satisfy Vishnu. That's Vaishnava.
So my understanding was Diksha is only to understand that.
No, Diksha is getting mantra and living one's life under the guidelines of the Vedas. Let's take, you know, Ravana. We'll take Ravana as an example. He was born of a very qualified Brahmana, Vishravas. His mother was another quality, but his father trained him when he was young in the Vedas. He received Vedic training. But he took a detour largely by the influence of his mother. And she instilled in him some other values. So he knew what the values were, but he didn't live by them. So he wasn't a Vaishnava. He wasn't trying to please Vishnu. He was trying to kill Vishnu and enjoy Vishnu's Shakti. So,
the other question also, when I was reading a little bit, is coming about our duties.
Yes.
And I was reading about it that, I think it's chapter 2, that Bhagavad Gita, that it's better to do your own duties imperfectly,
yes,
rather than doing duties of other perfectly. Where I got confused, that I thought duties done perfectly, maybe that's actually my duty, because how do I know what my duty is?
That's a good question.
Right, because I thought whatever I can do perfectly might be actually my duty, because that's what I'm designed to do.
Okay. You're a mother. And that's your duty. Supposing you could perfectly be a renunciate. That's not your duty. Your duty is a mother. You know, when your children grow up, you can decide to be more renounced or whatever you want to do. But your duty is your mother. And a wife. So you have these duties. Now, those are duties that presumably they match your nature. It's psychophysical nature. Somebody that's a renunciate that gets married, they'd be a terrible householder. And somebody that's a... Anyway, you get, so we each have our nature. So your question is, how do you know what your nature is? That's your question. Well, ideally is not how we operate usually, but ideally one receives some guidance from a spiritual master to understand this is your nature, and according to your nature, this should be your duty. Now, that's the classical guru-disciple understanding. But, you know, our modern times is not precisely like that. We don't live in the ashram of guru, and he's observing everything day in and day out. And therefore, he knows. I mean, this is in Bhishma Dev's teachings, Canto 1, Chapter 9. The teacher lives with the student, or the students live with the teacher, and he observes and says, this one has this propensity, that one has that propensity, and he gives them training according to propensity. They learn from their teacher, who has studied. They live with him. That's the classical sense of... And then an ashram, similarly. So varna and ashram, according to propensity. And then it's assigned by the guru. Because the guru knows. He's gifted by Krishna to know, and he sees, and he instructs and trains accordingly. That's the classic system. And for the rest of us, it's, you know, it's much more of a blur. But in your case, at least, you know, the duties of mother and husband... That's not unnatural. It's a choice that you made. So once you make choices, you abide by the choices you make. But it most likely matches your nature. That's ashram. And then there's duties with ashram. And then what about varna? Then, you know, there are ways that you can look at scripture and you understand my inclination is towards... Like she asked this question the other day. Not precisely the way that you're asking it. But, you know, one of the things that's her nature, she's very creative. She likes theatrical. Someone didn't have to wind her up. She likes it. And she's good at it. So, you know, that's something that says something about her nature, so she should act according to her nature and do that for Krishna. So, and each of us, we look inside. What are those gifts that God has given me? And that tells something about your nature. Your guna and your karma, a propensity. Vasana is a term. Propensity. Impressions that are stored, it can mean impressions, but then you store them up over a long period of time and there's a certain tendency to do something. A thief has his tendency. You know, a dancer has their tendency. A musician, Prabhupada said about John Lennon, in his previous life he was a celebrated musician. So when he was a child, he was a good musician. Vasana. Psychophysical nature. So, each of us have some. So how do we know? Introspection, know what scripture says, take some guidance. It's going to come out anyway because we have our nature. Some kids are good at science and math, and some people are good at art. And we encourage according to propensity. That's good parenting. Okay?
Right. Thank you. And if I have time, one last question today's class. So from the beginning, as you said, Narad Muni knew everything.
Yes.
So he also knew that eighth kid, which is Krishna, would be the one killing Kansa, then why did he tell Kansa a lie that, you know, oh, it can be any kid, so go kill all the kids?
It's described by Acharya as puzzling. Besides, it looks like, you know, that's nasty, and great personalities don't do nasty things. So it's like, why is he doing that? Why is he doing this nasty thing? He knew that, I mentioned it, I'm repeating, he knew that by the curse from a previous lifetime is that those six children that would be born as a daughter or sons of Devaki would be killed by their father. He knew, because it was a curse that would happen in this particular lifetime, so he knew it's just fulfilling that curse. And he also wanted to hasten Krishna's appearance, because it's part of Krishna's pastime to kill Kamsa. So he was hastening.
But Maharaj, how would that hasten the Krishna's appearance, which is because...
The children, right after birth, they were killed. Next. Right after their birth, they're killed. Next.
But those kids, if they were not killed, they would go live their destiny.
However long they would live, and then be killed. So it was hastening Krishna. Oh, I see. I see.
The time-wise, whatever science, like every year, next kid.
Okay. I'll research and let you know. I'm sure there's an explanation. And I'm not thinking of that, because that's a good point.
Thank you, Maharaj, for your time.
Okay. Others? Here's the microphone, so there are people online can hear you.
On her thing of why the six were killed just at birth, as long as I knew, I heard the story from my grandma, saying that they were good souls, but for something bad that they had done in their past life, they needed quick moksha from the underworld, from the sin, or from living through again.
That's a nice
answer. That's why Kamsa had to kill them right.
Or not, where Narada was instigating him to do so.
To do so, yes.
So to finish their bad karma quickly.
That's right.
An act of mercy.
Mm-hmm. Because they were very good souls for some, like how Kamsa came into the world, because...
Well, whether they were good souls or not good souls, mm-hmm. their bad deeds that brought them to that position would be finished. Mm. Okay. Maybe that's it. But if I come up with something else, I'll let you know.
Sure.
That's a very good answer.
Thank you. No, I just remembered my...
Who'd you hear that from?
My grandma. She would tell when you're young kids, she would say, I love to hear Krishna. So, no, I become emotional. But every night, poor thing, she's...
How much time did she spend telling you Krishna stories every night?
Every night, I think up to
an hour
of five. Oh, I don't know. I would just wake up till she finished, complete the story of how he was birthed, how Kamsa was killed. I didn't let her sleep. Poor thing. I was thinking of her now. Like now my grandkids say, Grandma, say this. I'm so tired, like to sleep, but I kept her up.
And did she tell you Krishna stories? So be Grandma.
Oh yeah, I'm grandma for all of them, but I'm just one of their neighbors here.
Okay.
Just came visiting.
Okay.
But, yeah, thank you.
Hare Krishna Maharaj.
Keep it short so we can encourage
yes.
our
sure,
others.
Sure, Maharaj. So I wanted to understand, my understanding was, like when you love someone, then you pay very much attention to all the details. So I was thinking that Akrura was not paying attention to where he's going from point A. I mean, he was so absorbed. So I'm just trying to understand for myself, like sometimes I might get into enjoyment spirit and feel like, okay, this is service, but in that light, if you would like to say something.
Well, it's not that if you're in ecstasy, you become oblivious. Or it's not that if you're... but he was not in... contemplating about himself. He was absorbed in thought of Krishna, so much so he lost track of the externals. So we may lose track of the externals for a variety of reasons. We're miserable or we're happy, but it's not the same as what Akur was experiencing. He was in waves of ecstasy.
Sure.
Another realm. Okay. Okay. We're going to do some online questions. Oh, you have something. Go ahead. Go ahead.
Thank you. Maharaj, I was just appreciating, pretty much connected to what she was asking also, that the way those four verses that we have done of Akrura's today, I was just contemplating that he was so much relishing the thoughts of Krishna, that anticipation of meeting Krishna itself was giving him so much pleasure, that in the last verse that we heard, he was grateful. And so I'm just thinking about how grateful he was about this thinking about Krishna, that even before meeting him, he was able to feel it. Is this what we can, in you know, modern terms, say this is mindfulness, or is this more of a mercy that he has?
It's more than mindfulness. It's mindfulness plus.
Yeah.
Super high test mindfulness. It's ecstatic. Mindfulness has its different meanings to different people. I was invited to attend a program at University of Illinois in Chicago. It was an evening program, and on our way we passed one of the shops was the Mindful Burger. Marketing, you know, take the word and market it. So it means different things to different people. It means something very different to a Buddhist, or it means something very different to the mindful manager, the business people use that term. Because it's just, anyway, it means different things to different people. But it's mindfulness, but it's beyond, way beyond an ordinary sense of mindfulness. It was samadhi. He was in samadhi while carrying out a service. Now, one can be in samadhi carrying out a service and not lose track of time and space. But he did. It's not like that made him more elevated than one who's in samadhi while performing external activity. Like a nice example of this is Uddhava. In Canto 3, Uddhava is met by Vidura. And Vidura says, "Oh, Uddhavaji," and then starts asking questions about Krishna. And just hearing topics about Krishna, Uddhava went into a trance. He went to Krishna. Just thinking of Krishna, he was so absorbed. And then he struggled to come back to external consciousness in order to answer and respond to Vidura's questions. And as he was answering Vidura's questions, it wasn't like he left samadhi. He was in samadhi. And, you know, he was serving Uncle Akrura through external activity with mind completely absorbed. So mindfulness can mean different things at different stages to different people. Do we have some online questions? Okay. Let's do some online, then we'll do yours.
There is no online question.
None? Oh, okay. Okay, go ahead.
Maharaj, the way Kamsa spoke to Akrura as a request in a nice way, and you had mentioned that how Ravana also was like that to Maricha, but the moment they hear an answer of no, then their real nature comes out. So I was thinking, like, within devotee circle also sometimes I request for some service and with an expectation built that, you know, yes will be an answer, but no comes, there is some disturbance that happens. So So that Kamsa quality or Ravana quality comes out. So what to do to prevent it? What should be the mode?
Nimitta matra bhavya savya sachin. That's how. You're just an instrument. The service is to Krishna, and you're an instrument of Krishna's service, and someone like Krishna said to Arjuna, "What do you decide what you want to do?" And he could have said yes or no. He wanted him to say yes, but if he'd said no, then that's... So you don't have expectation other than you're an instrument. Do your instrument service nicely, and whatever comes, you accept. Because Krishna is the fulfiller of everyone's desires, including the people that want to say no. And it could be all kinds of why the reason is no. Who knows what the reason is? What they say may not be what the real reason is. But so you don't act as the controller of the outcomes of things. You act as the instrument of service to Krishna. Expectations of results.
Maharaj, we were listening to a class yesterday or day before yesterday. So Ravana and Vibhishana, both of them received same kind of, you know, from their father. But both of them went opposite directions. Vibhishana is Lord Ram's, you know, he's a devotee, but then Ravana went the other way. Even though they had gone through the same kind of, you know, teachings through their father, but so what possibly could be the reason, Maharaj?
What's possibly the reason? Well, our hostess was giving the answer, you know, there's nature. And I was explaining vasana. So, you know, Kamsa's nature was diabolical, and it was inflamed by his mother. Now Vibhishan had the same mother, but Vibhishan had a different nature, different tendency. You know how this happened. When the mother basically proposed to her husband to be, please provide me with children. She didn't say, she was scratching the ground with her toe, and she said, "You're a rishi, you know. I don't have to tell you why I've come. She said, "You want to have children, but you've come at an inauspicious time. So your children will be the scourge of the universe." And she said, "Oh no, I don't want children like that." He said, "Well, it's already too late. But I'll tell you that the younger son will have a nature like me." So where did he, what was his previous life, Vibhishan's previous life? We don't know. Ramayana doesn't say who he was in his previous life. But, you know, a great soul. And he had a role to play in Ram's Leela, and so he took birth the way that he took birth. He had a previous disposition, and through his father's association, that disposition was enriched and fully matured. He heard from his father, he studied the Vedas, when he did austerities, this is described. Same time, the three of them, three brothers, long austerities, very details what those austerities were. Brahma came, "What do you want, Vibhishan?" I want to be righteous throughout my whole life and never deviate from the truth, and this is what I want. So be it. Ravan had a different idea. So, they had a different nature, although the same father, same mother, they had a different nature, and that nature came out. In our back row back there, Eddie? Nothing? Okay. So, we're done? You have something more? Okay. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.